4. "Who was that?" Jake Blunt asked. "Who was that tall, thin, colored man that just come out of here?" The small room was very neat. The sun lighted a bowl of purple grapes on the table. Singer sat with his chair tilted back and his hands in his pockets, looking out of the window. "I bumped into him on the steps, and he gave me this look. Why, I never had anybody to look at me so dirty." Jake put the sack of ales down on the table. He realized with a shock that Singer did not know he was in the room. He walked over to the window and touched Singer on the shoulder. "I didn't mean to bump into him. He had no cause to act like that." Jake shivered. Although the sun was bright, there was a chill in the room. Singer held up his forefinger and went into the hall. When he returned, he brought with him a scuttle of coal and some kindling. Jake watched him kneel before the hearth. Neatly, he broke the sticks of kindling over his knee and arranged them on the foundation of paper. He put the coal on according to a system. At first, the fire would not draw. The flames quivered weakly and were smothered by a black roll of smoke. Singer covered the grate with a double sheet of newspaper. The draft gave the fire new life. In the room, there was a roaring sound. The paper glowed and was sucked inward. A crackling orange sheet of flame filled the grate. The first morning ale had a fine, mellow taste. Jake gulped his share down quickly and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. "There was this lady I knew a long time ago," he said. "You sort of remind me of her, Miss Clara. She had a little farm in Texas and made pralines to sell in the cities. She was a tall, big, fine-looking lady. Wore those long, baggy sweaters and clodhopper shoes and a man's hat. Her husband was dead when I knew her. But what I'm getting at is this. If it hadn't been for her, I might never have known. I might have gone on through life like the millions of others who don't know. I would have just been a preacher or a lint head or a salesman. My whole life might have been wasted." Jake shook his head wonderingly. "To understand, you gotta know what went before. You see, I lived in Gastonia when I was a young'un. I was a knock-kneed little runt, too small to put in the mill. I worked as a pin boy in a bowling joint and got meals for pay. Then I heard a smart quick boy could make 30 cents a day stringing tobacco not very far from there. So I went and made that 30 cents a day. That was when I was 10 years old. I just left my folks. Didn't write. They were glad I was gone. You understand how those things are. Besides, nobody could read a letter but my sister." He waved his hand in the air as though brushing something from his face. "But I mean this. My first belief was Jesus. There was this fellow working in the same shed with me. He had a tabernacle and preached every night. I went and listened, and I got this faith. My mind was on Jesus all day long. In my spare time, I studied the Bible and prayed. Then one night, I took a hammer and laid my hand on the table. I was angry, and I drove the nail all the way through. My hand was nailed to the table, and I looked at it, and the fingers fluttered and turned blue." Jake held out his palm and pointed to the ragged, dead-white scar in the center. "I wanted to be an evangelist. I meant to travel around the country preaching and holding revivals. In the meantime, I moved around from one place to another. And when I was nearly 20, I got to Texas. I worked in a pecan grove near where Miss Clara lived. I got to know her. And at night sometimes I would go to her house. She talked to me. Understand, I didn't begin to know all at once. That's not the way it happens to any of us. It was gradual. I began to read. I would work just so I could put aside enough money to knock off for a while and study. It was like being born a second time. Just us who know can understand what it means. We have opened our eyes and have seen. We're like people from way off yonder somewhere." Singer agreed with him. The room was comfortable in a homey way. Singer brought out from the closet the tin box in which he kept crackers and fruit and cheese. He selected an orange and peeled it slowly. He pulled off shreds of pith until the fruit was transparent in the sun. He sectioned the orange and divided the plugs between them. Jake ate two sections at a time, and with a loud whoosh spat the seeds into the fire. Singer ate his share slowly and deposited his seeds neatly in the palm of one hand. They opened two more ales.
"And how many of us are there in this country? Maybe 10,000? Maybe 20,000? Maybe a lot more. I've been to a lot of places, but I never met but a few of us. But say a man does know. He sees the world as it is, and he looks back thousands of years to see how it all come about. He watches the slow agglutination of capital and power, and he sees its pinnacle today. He sees America as a crazy house. He sees how men have to rob their brothers in order to live. He sees children starving and women working 60 hours a week to get to eat. He sees a whole damn army of unemployed and billions of dollars and thousands of miles of land wasted. He sees war coming. He sees how when people suffer just so much they get mean and ugly and something dies in them. But the main thing he sees is that the whole system of the world is built on a lie. And although it's as plain as a shining sun, the don't-knows have lived with that lie so long they just can't see it."
The red-corded vein in Jake's forehead swelled angrily. He grasped the scuttle on the hearth and rattled an avalanche of coal on the fire. His foot had gone to sleep, and he stamped it so hard that the floor shook.
"I've been all over this place. I walk around. I talk. I try to explain to them, but what good does it do? Lord God!"
He gazed into the fire, and a flush from the ale and heat deepened the color of his face. The sleepy tingling in his foot spread up his leg. He drowsed and saw the colors of the fire, the tints of green and blue and burning yellow.
"You're the only one," he said dreamily. "The only one."
He was a stranger no longer. By now he knew every street, every alley, every fence, and all the sprawling slums of the town. He still worked at the Sunny Dixie. During the fall, the show moved from one vacant lot to another, staying always within the fringes of the city limit until at last it had encircled the town. The locations were changed, but the settings were alike: a strip of wasteland bordered by rows of rotted shacks, and somewhere near a mill, a cotton gin, or a bottling plant. The crowd was the same, for the most part, factory workers and Negroes. The show was gaudy, with colored lights in the evening. The wooden horses of the Flying Jenny revolved in the circle to the mechanical music. The swings whirled, the rail around the penny-throwing game was always crowded. From the two booths were sold drinks and bloody brown hamburgers and cotton candy. He had been hired as a machinist, but gradually the range of his duties widened. His coarse, bawling voice called out through the noise, and continually he was lounging from one place on the showgrounds to another. Sweat stood out on his forehead, and often his mustache was soaked with beer. On Saturday, his job was to keep the people in order. His squat, hard body pushed through the crowd with savage energy. Only his eyes did not share the violence of the rest of him. Wide gazing beneath his massive, scowling forehead, they had a withdrawn and distracted appearance. He reached home between 12 and 1 in the morning. The house where he lived was squared into 4 rooms, and the rent was $1.50 per person. There was a privy in the back and a hydrant on the stoop. In his room, the walls and floor had a wet, sour smell. Sooty, cheap lace curtains hung at the window. He kept his good suit in his bag and hung his overalls on a nail. The room had no heat and no electricity. However, a street light shone outside the window and made a pale greenish reflection inside. He never lighted the oil lamp by his bed unless he wanted to read. The acrid smell of burning oil in the cold room nauseated him. If he stayed at home, he restlessly walked the floor. He sat on the edge of the unmade bed and gnawed savagely at the broken, dirty ends of his fingernails. The sharp taste of grime lingered in his mouth. The loneliness in him was so keen that he was filled with terror. Usually he had a pint of bootleg White Lightning. He drank the raw liquor, and by daylight he was warm and relaxed. At 5 o'clock, the whistles from the mills blew for the first shift. The whistles made lost, eerie echoes, and he could never sleep until after they had sounded. But usually he did not stay at home. He went out into the narrow, empty streets. In the first dark hours of the morning, the sky was black and the stars hard and bright. Sometimes the mills were running. From the yellow-lighted buildings came the racket of the machines. He waited at the gates for the early shift. Young girls in sweaters and print dresses came out into the dark street. The men came out carrying their dinner pails. Some of them always went to a streetcar cafe for Coca-Cola or coffee before going home, and Jake went with them. Inside the noisy mill, the men could hear, plainly, every word that was spoken. But for the first hour outside, they were deaf. In the streetcar, Jake drank Coca-Cola with whiskey added. He talked. The winter dawn was white and smoky and cold. He looked with drunken urgency into the drawn yellow faces of the men. Often he was laughed at, and when this happened, he held his stunted body very straight and spoke scornfully in words of many syllables. He stuck his little finger out from his glass and haughtily twisted his mustache. And if he was still laughed at, he sometimes fought. He swung his big brown fists with crazed violence and sobbed aloud. After such mornings, he returned to the show with relief. It eased him to push through the crowds of people, the noise, the rank stinks, the shouldering contact of human flesh soothed his jangled nerves. Because of the blue laws in the town, the show closed for the Sabbath. On Sunday, he got up early in the morning and took from the suitcase his serge suit. He went to the main street. First, he dropped into the New York Cafe and bought a sack of ales. Then he went to Singer's room. Although he knew many people in the town by name or face, the mute was his only friend. They would idle in the quiet room and drink the ales. He would talk, and the words created themselves from the dark mornings spent in the streets or in his room alone. The words were formed and spoken with relief. The fire had died down. Singer was playing a game of fools with himself at the table. Jake had been asleep. He awoke with a nervous quiver. He raised his head and turned to Singer. "Yeah," he said, as though in answer to a sudden question. "Some of us are communists, but not all of us. Myself, I'm not a member of the Communist Party, because in the first place, I never knew but one of them. You can bum around for years and not meet communists. Round here, there's no office where you can go up and say you want to join. And if there is, I never heard of it. And you just don't take off for New York and join. As I say, I never knew but one. And he was a seedy little teetotaler whose breath stunk. We had a fight. Not that I hold that against the communists. The main fact is, I don't think so much of Stalin and Russia. I hate every damn country and government there is. But even so, maybe I ought to join up with the communists in the first place. I'm not certain one way or the other. What do you think?" Singer wrinkled his forehead and considered. He reached for his silver pencil and wrote on his pad a paper that he didn't know. "But there's this. You see, we just can't settle down after knowing, but we got to act. And some of us go nuts. There's too much to do, and you don't know where to start. It makes you crazy. Even me. I've done things that when I look back at them, they don't seem rational. Once I started an organization myself, I picked out 20 lint heads and talked to them until I thought they knew. Our motto was one word. Action. Pah. We meant to start riots, stir up all the big trouble we could. Our ultimate goal was freedom, but a real freedom, a great freedom, made possible only by the sense of justice of the human soul. Our motto, action, signified the raising of capitalism. In the Constitution, drawn up by myself,
Certain statutes dealt with the swapping of our motto from action to freedom as soon as our work was through. Jake sharpened the end of a match and picked a troublesome cavity in a tooth. After a moment, he continued. Then when the Constitution was all written down and the first followers well organized, then I went out on a hitchhiking tour to organize component units of the society. Within 3 months, I came back, and what do you reckon I found? What was a first heroic action? Had their righteous fury overcome planned action so that they had gone ahead without me? Was it destruction? Or murder? Revolution? Jake leaned forward in his chair. After a pause, he said somberly, My friend, they had stole the $57.30 from the treasury to buy uniform caps and free Saturday suppers. I caught them sitting around the conference table, rolling the bones, their caps on their heads and a ham and a gallon of gin in easy reach. A timid smile from Singer followed Jake's outburst of laughter. After a while, the smile on Singer's face grew strained and faded. Jake still laughed. The vein in his forehead swelled. His face was dusky red. He laughed too long. Singer looked up at the clock and indicated the time, 12:30. He took his watch, his silver pencil and pad, his cigarettes and matches from the mantel and distributed them among his pockets. It was dinner time. But Jake still laughed. There was something maniacal in the sound of his laughter. He walked about the room, jingling the change in his pockets. His long, powerful arms swung tense and awkward. He began to name over parts of his coming meal. When he spoke of food, his face was fierce with gusto. With each word, he raised his upper lip like a ravenous animal.
Roast beef with gravy, rice, and cabbage, and light bread, and a big hunk of apple pie. I'm famished. Oh, Johnny, I can hear the Yankees coming. And speaking of meals, my friend, did I ever tell you about Mr. Clark Patterson, the gentleman who owns the Sonny Dixie Show? He's so fat, he hasn't seen his privates for 20 years. And all day he sits in his trailer playing solitaire and smoking reefers. He orders his meals from a short order joint nearby, and every day he breaks his fast with...
Jake stepped back so that Singer could leave the room. He always hung back at doorways when he was with the mute. He always followed and expected Singer to lead. As they descended the stairs, he continued to talk with nervous volubility. He kept his brown, wide eyes on Singer's face. The afternoon was soft and mild. They stayed indoors. Jake had brought back with them a quart of whiskey. He sat brooding and silent on the foot of the bed, leaning now and then to fill his glass from the bottle on the floor. Singer was at his table by the window playing a game of chess. Jake had relaxed somewhat. He watched the game of his friend and felt the mild, quiet afternoon merge with the darkness of evening. The firelight made dark, silent waves on the walls of the room. But at night, the tension came in him again. Singer had put away his chessmen, and they sat facing each other. Nervousness made Jake's lips twitch raggedly, and he drank to soothe himself. A backwash of restlessness and desire overcame him. He drank down the whiskey and began to talk again to Singer. The words swelled within him and gushed from his mouth. He walked from the window to the bed and back again, again and again, and at last the deluge of swollen words took shape, and he delivered them to the mute with drunken emphasis.
The things they have done to us, the truths they have turned into lies, ideals they have fouled and made vile. Take Jesus. He was one of us. He knew when he said that it is harder for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. He damn well meant just what he said. But look what the church has done to Jesus during the last 2,000 years. What they have made of him. How they have turned every word he spoke for their own vile ends. Jesus would be framed and in jail if he was living today. Jesus would be one who really knows me and Jesus would sit across the table, and I would look at him, and he would look at me, and we would both know that the other knew. Me and Jesus and Karl Marx could all sit at a table and look what has happened to our freedom. The men who fought the American Revolution were no more like these D.A.R. dames than I'm a pot-bellied, perfume-pickanese dog. They meant what they said about freedom. They fought a real revolution. They fought so that this could be a country where every man would be free and equal. Ha! And that meant every man was equal in the sight of nature, with an equal chance. This didn't mean that 20% of the people were free to rob the other 80% of the means to live. This didn't mean for one rich man to sweat the piss out of 10,000 poor men so that he can get richer. This didn't mean the tyrants were free to get this country in such a fix that millions of people are ready to do anything, cheat, lie, or whack off their right arm just to work for 3 squares and a flop. They have made the word freedom a blasphemy. You hear me? They have made the word freedom stink like a skunk to all who know.
The vein in Jake's forehead throbbed wildly. His mouth worked convulsively. Singer sat up, alarmed. Jake tried to speak again, and the words choked in his mouth. A shudder passed through his body. He sat down in the chair and pressed his trembling lips with his fingers. Then he said huskily,
"It's this way, Singer. Being mad is no good. Nothing we can do is any good. That's the way it seems to me. All we can do is go around telling the truth. And as soon as enough of the don't-knows have learned the truth, then there won't be any use for fighting. The only thing for us to do is let them know all that's needed. But how? Huh?"
The fire shadows lapped against the walls. The dark, shadowy waves rose higher, and the room took on motion. The room rose and fell, and all balance was gone. Alone, Jake felt himself sink downward, slowly, in wave-like motions, downward into a shadowed ocean. In helplessness and terror, he strained his eyes, but he could see nothing except the dark and scarlet waves that roared hungrily over him. Then at last he made out the thing which he sought. The mute's face was faint and very far away. Jake closed his eyes. The next morning, he awoke very late. Singer had been gone for hours. There was bread, cheese, an orange, and a pot of coffee on the table. When he had finished his breakfast, it was time for work. He walked somberly, his head bent, across the town toward his room. When he reached the neighborhood where he lived, he passed through a certain narrow street that was flanked on one side by a smoke-blackened brick warehouse. On the wall of this building, there was something that vaguely distracted him. He started to walk on, and then his attention was suddenly held. On the wall, a message was written in bright red chalk, the letters drawn thickly and curiously formed. "Ye shall eat the flesh of the mighty, and drink the blood of the princes of the earth." He read the message twice and looked anxiously up and down the street. No one was in sight. After a few minutes of puzzled deliberation, he took from his pocket a thick red pencil and wrote carefully beneath the inscription, "Whoever wrote the above, meet me here tomorrow at noon, Wednesday, November 29, or the next day." At 12 o'clock the next day, he waited before the wall. Now and then he walked impatiently to the corner to look up and down the streets. No one came. After an hour, he had to leave for the show. The next day, he waited also. Then on Friday, there was a long, slow winter rain. The wall was sodden, and the messages streaked so that no word could be read. The rain continued, gray and bitter, and cold. 5.
Mick, Bubber said, I come to believe we all gonna drown.
It was true that it liked to never quit raining. Mrs. Wells rode them back and forth to school in her car, and every afternoon they had to stay on the front porch or in the house. She and Bubber played Parcheesi and Old Maid and shot marbles on the living room rug. It was nearing along toward Christmas time, and Bubber began to talk about the little Lord Jesus and the red bicycle he wanted Santa Claus to bring him. The rain was silver on the window panes, and the sky was wet and cold and gray. The river rose so high that some of the factory people had to move out of their houses. Then, when it looked like the rain would keep on and on forever, it suddenly stopped. They woke up one morning, and the bright sun was shining. By afternoon, the weather was almost warm as summer. Mick came home late from school, and Bubber and Ralph and Spare Ribs were on the front sidewalk. The kids looked hot and sticky, and their winter clothes had a sour smell. Bubber had a slingshot and a pocket full of rocks. Ralph sat up in his wagon, his hat crooked on his head, and he was fretful. Spare Ribs had his new rifle with him. The sky was a wonderful blue.
We waited for you a long time, Mick, Bubber said. Where you been?
She jumped up the front steps three at a time and threw her sweater toward the hat rack.
Practicing on the piano in the gym?
Every afternoon, she stayed after school for an hour to play. The gym was crowded and noisy because the girls' team had basketball games. Twice today, she was hit on the head with the ball. But getting a chance to sit at a piano was worth any amount of knocks and trouble. She would arrange bunches of notes together until the sound came that she wanted. It was easier than she had thought. After the first two or three hours, she figured out some sets of chords in the bass that would fit in with the main tune her right hand was playing. She could pick out almost any piece now. And she made up new music, too. That was better than just copying tunes. When her hands hunted out these beautiful new sounds, it was the best feeling she had ever known. She wanted to learn how to read music already written down. Dolores Brown had taken music lessons for 5 years. She paid Dolores the 50 cents a week she got for lunch money to give her lessons. This made her very hungry all through the day. Dolores played a good many fast, runny pieces, but Dolores did not know how to answer all the questions she wanted to know. Dolores only taught her about the different scales, the major and minor chords, the values of the notes, and such beginning rules as those. Mick slammed the door of the kitchen stove.
This all we got to eat?
Honey, it the best I can do for you, Portia said. Just corn pones and margarine. As she ate, she drank a glass of water to help wash down the swallows.
Quit acting so greedy. Nobody gonna snatch it out of your hand?
The kids still hung around in front of the house. Bubber had put his slingshot in his pocket, and now he played with the rifle. Spare Ribs was 10 years old, and his father had died the month before, and this had been his father's gun. All the smaller kids loved to handle that rifle. Every few minutes, Bubber would haul the gun up to his shoulder. He took aim and made a loud pow sound.
Don't monkey with the trigger, said Spare Ribs. I got the gun loaded.
Mick finished the cornbread and looked around for something to do. Harry Minowitz was sitting on his front porch banisters with the newspaper. She was glad to see him. For a joke, she threw up her arm and hollered to him,
Hal!
But Harry didn't take it as a joke. He went into his front hall and shut the door. It was easy to hurt his feelings. She was sorry because lately she and Harry had been right good friends. They had always played in the same gang when they were kids, but in the last 3 years, he had been at vocational while she was still in grammar school. Also, he worked at part-time jobs. He grew up very suddenly and quit hanging around the back and front yards with kids. Sometimes she could see him reading the paper in his bedroom or undressing late at night. In mathematics and history, he was the smartest boy at vocational. Often, now that she was in high school too, They would meet each other on the way home and walk together. They were in the same shop class, and once the teacher made them partners to assemble a motor. He read books and kept up with the newspapers every day. World politics were all the time on his mind. He talked slow, and sweat stood out on his forehead when he was very serious about something. And now she had made him mad with her.
"I wonder, has Harry still got his gold piece?" Spareib said.
"What gold piece?"
"When a Jew boy is born, they put a gold piece in the bank for him. That's what Jews do."
"Shucks, you got it mixed up," she said.
"It's Catholics you're thinking about. Catholics buy a pistol for a baby soon as it's born. Someday the Catholics mean to start a war and kill everybody else."
"Nuns give me a funny feeling," Spareib said. "It scares me when I see one on the street." She sat down on the steps and laid her head on her knees. She went into the inside room. With her, it was like there were two places, the inside room and the outside room. School and the family and the things that happened every day were in the outside room. Mr. Singer was in both rooms. Foreign countries and plans and music were in the inside room. The songs she thought about were there, and the symphony. When she was by herself in this inside room, the music she had heard that night after the party would come back to her. This symphony grew slow like a big flower in her mind. During the day sometimes, or when she had just waked up in the morning, a new part of the symphony would suddenly come to her. Then she would have to go into the inside room and listen to it many times and try to join it into the parts of the symphony she remembered. The inside room was a very private place. She could be in the middle of a house full of people and still feel like she was locked up by herself. Spareib stuck his dirty hand up to her eyes because she had been staring off at space. She slapped him.
"What is a nun?" Bubber asked.
"A Catholic lady," Spareib said.
"A Catholic lady with a big black dress that comes up over her head."
She was tired of hanging around with the kids. She would go to the library and look at pictures in the National Geographic, photographs of all the foreign places in the world, Paris, France, and big ice glaciers, and the wild jungles in Africa.
"You kids see that Ralph don't get out in the street," she said.
Bubba rested the big rifle on his shoulder.
"Bring me a story back with you."
It was like that kid had been born knowing how to read. He was only in the second grade, but he loved to read stories by himself, and he never asked anybody else to read to him.
"What kind you want this time?"
"Pick out some stories with something to eat in them. I like that one a whole lot about them German kids going out in the forest and coming to this house made out of all different kinds of candy and the witch. I like a story with something to eat in it."
"I'll look for one," said Mick.
"But I'm getting kind of tired of candy," Bubber said.
"See if you can't bring me a story with something like a barbecue sandwich in it. But if you can't find none of them, I'd like a cowboy story."
She was ready to leave when suddenly she stopped and stared. The kids stared too. They all stood still and looked at Baby Wilson coming down the steps of her house across the street.
"Ain't Baby cute?" said Bubber softly.
Maybe it was the sudden hot sunny day after all those rainy weeks. Maybe it was because their dark winter clothes were ugly to them on an afternoon like this one. Anyway, Baby looked like a fairy or something in the picture show. She had on her last year's soiree costume, with a little pink gauze skirt that stuck out short and stiff, a pink body waist, pink dancing shoes, and even a little pink pocketbook. With her yellow hair, she was all pink and white and gold, and so small and clean that it almost hurt to watch her. She prissed across the street in a cute way, but would not turn her face toward them.
"Come over here," said Bubber. "Let me look at your little pink pocketbook."
Baby passed them along the edge of the street with her head held to one side. She had made up her mind not to speak to them. There was a strip of grass between the sidewalk and the street, and when Baby reached it, she stood still for a second and then turned a handspring Don't pay no mind to her, said Spare Ribs. She always tries to show off. She's going down to Mr. Brannon's cafe to get candy. He's her uncle, and she gets it free. Bubba rested the end of the rifle on the ground. The big gun was too heavy for him. As he watched Baby walk off down the street, he kept pulling the straggly bangs of his hair. That sure is a cute little pink pocketbook, he said. Her mama always talks about how talented she is, said Spare Ribs. She thinks she's gonna get Baby in the movies. It was too late to go look at the National Geographic. Supper was almost ready. Ralph tuned up to cry, and she took him off the wagon and put him on the ground. Now it was December, and to a kid Bubber's age, that was a long time from summer. All last summer, Baby had come out in that pink soiree costume and danced in the middle of the street. At first, the kids would flock around and watch her, but soon they got tired of it. Bubber was the only one who would watch her as she came out to dance. He would sit on the curb and yell to her when he saw a car coming. He had watched Baby do her soiree dance 100 times, but summer had been gone for 3 months, and now it seemed new to him again. I sure do wish I had a costume, Bubber said. Or what kind do you want? A real cool costume. A real pretty one made out of all different colors. Like a butterfly. That's what I want for Christmas, that, and a bicycle. Sissy, said Spare Ribs. Bubber hauled the big rifle up to his shoulder again and took aim at a house across the street. I'd dance around in my costume if I had one. I'd wear it every day to school. Mick sat on the front steps and kept her eyes on Ralph. Bubber wasn't a sissy like Spare Ribs said. He just loved pretty things. She'd better not let old Spare Ribs get away with that. A person's got to fight for every single thing they get, she said slowly. And I've noticed a lot of times that the farther down a kid comes in the family, the better the kid really is. Younger kids are always the toughest. I'm pretty hard because I got a lot of them on top of me. Bubber, he looks sick and likes pretty things, but he's got guts underneath that. If all this is true, Ralph sure ought to be a real strong one when he's old enough to get around. Even though he's just 17 months old, I can read something hard and tough in that Ralph's face already. Ralph looked around because he knew he was being talked about. Spare Rib sat down on the ground and grabbed Ralph's hat off his head and shook it in his face to tease him. All right, Mick said. You know what I'll do to you if you start him to cry. You just better watch out. Everything was quiet. The sun was behind the roofs of the houses, and the sky in the west was purple and pink. On the next block, there was the sound of kids skating. Bubber leaned up against a tree, and he seemed to be dreaming about something. The smell of supper came out of the house, and it would be time to eat soon.
Look it, Bubber said suddenly. Here comes Baby again. She sure is pretty in the pink costume.
Baby walked toward them slowly. She had been given a prize box of popcorn candy and was reaching in the box for the prize. She walked in that same prissy, dainty way. You could tell that she knew they were all looking at her.
Please, Baby, Bubber said when she started to pass them. Let me see your little pink pocketbook and touch your pink costume.
Baby started humming a song to herself and did not listen. She passed by without letting Bubber play with her. She only ducked her head and grinned at him a little. Bubber still had the big rifle up to his shoulder. He made a loud pow sound and pretended like he had shot. Then he called to Baby again in a soft, sad voice like he was calling a little kitty.
Please? Baby? Come here. Baby?
He was too quick for Mick to stop him. She had just seen his hand on the trigger when there was the terrible ping of the gun. Baby crumpled down to the sidewalk. It was like she was nailed to the steps and couldn't move or scream. Spare Ribs had his arm up over his head. Bubba was the only one that didn't realize.
Get up, Baby, he hollered. I ain't mad with you.
It all happened in a second. The three of them reached Baby at the same time. She lay crumpled down on the dirty sidewalk. Her skirt was over her head, showing her pink panties and her little white legs. Her hands were open. In one, there was the prize from the candy, and in the other, the pocketbook. There was blood all over her hair ribbon and the top of her yellow curls. She was shot in the head, and her face was turned down toward the ground. So much happened in a second. Bubber screamed and dropped the gun and ran. She stood with her hands up to her face and screamed, too. Then there were many people. Her dad was the first to get there. He carried Baby into the house.
"She's dead," said Spare Ribs. "She's shot through the eyes. I've seen her face."
Mick walked up and down the sidewalk, and her tongue stuck in her mouth when she tried to ask, was Baby killed? Mrs. Wilson came running down the block from the beauty parlor where she worked. She went into the house and came back out again. She walked up and down in the street, crying and pulling a ring on and off her finger. Then the ambulance came, and the doctor went into Baby. Mick followed him. Baby was lying on the bed in the front room. The house was quiet as a church. Baby looked like a pretty little doll on the bed. Except for the blood, she did not seem hurt. The doctor bent over and looked at her head. After he finished, they took Baby out on a stretcher. Mrs. Wilson and her dad got into the ambulance with her. The house was still quiet. Everybody had forgotten about Bubber. He was nowhere around. An hour passed. Her mama and Hazel and Etta and all the boarders waited in the front room. Mr. Singer stood in the doorway. After a long time, her dad came home. He said Baby wouldn't die, but that her skull was fractured. He asked for Bubber. Nobody knew where he was. It was dark outside. They called Bubber in the backyard and in the street. They sent Spare Ribs and some other boys out to hunt for him. It looked like Bubber had gone clear out of the neighborhood. Harry went around to a house where they thought he might be. Her dad walked up and down the front porch. "I never have whipped any of my kids yet," he kept saying. "I never believed in it. But I'm sure gonna lay it onto that kid as soon as I get my hands on him." Mick sat on the banisters and watched down the dark street.
"I can manage Bubber. Once he comes back, I can take care of him all right."
"You go out and hunt for him. You can find him better than anybody else." As soon as her dad said that, she suddenly knew where Bubber was. In the backyard, there was a big oak, and in the summer they had built a treehouse. They had hauled a big box up in this oak, and Bubber used to love to sit up in the treehouse by himself. Mick left the family and the boarders on the front porch and walked back through the alley to the dark yard. She stood for a minute by the trunk of the tree.
"Bubber,"
she said quietly.
"It's Mick."
He didn't answer, but she knew he was there. It was like she could smell him. She swung up on the lowest branch and climbed slowly. She was really mad with that kid and would have to teach him a lesson. When she reached the treehouse, she spoke to him again, and still there wasn't any answer. She climbed into the big box and felt around the edges. At last, she touched him. He was scrooged up in a corner, and his legs were trembling. He had been holding his breath, and when she touched him, the sobs and the breath came out all at once.
I didn't mean for Baby to fall. She was just so little and cute. It seemed to me like I just had to take a pop at her."
Mick sat down on the floor of the treehouse.
"Baby's dead," she said. "They got a lot of people hunting for you."
Bubber quit crying. He was very quiet. "You know what Dad's doing in the house?" It was like she could hear Bubber listening. "You know Warden Laws? You heard him over the radio? And you know Sing Sing? Well, our dad's writing a letter to Warden Laws for him to be a little bit kind to you when they catch you and send you to Sing Sing." The words were so awful sounding in the dark that a shiver came over her. She could feel Bubber trembling.
They got little electric chairs there, just your size. And when they turn on the juice, you just fry up like a piece of burnt bacon. Then you go to hell.
Bubba was squeezed up in the corner, and there was not a sound from him. She climbed over the edge of the box to get down.
You better stay up here because they got policemen guarding the yard. Maybe in a few days I can bring you something to eat.
Mick leaned against the trunk of the oak tree. That would teach Bubba all right. She had always managed him, and she knew more about that kid than anybody else. Once, about a year or two ago, he was always wanting to stop off behind bushes and pee and play with himself a while. She had caught on to that pretty quick. She gave him a good slap every time it happened, and in 3 days he was cured. Afterwards, he never even peed normal like other kids. He held his hands behind him. She always had to nurse that bubber, and she could always manage him. In a little while, she would go back up to the treehouse and bring him in. After this, he would never want to pick up a gun again in all his life. There was still this dead feeling in the house. The boarders all sat on the front porch without talking or rocking in the chairs. Her dad and her mama were in the front room. Her dad drank beer out of a bottle and walked up and down the floor. Baby was going to get well, all right, so this worry was not about her. And nobody seemed to be anxious about Bubber. It was something else.
That Bubber? Said Etta. I'm ashamed to go out of the house after this, Hazel said.
Etta and Hazel went into the middle room and closed the door. Bill was in his room at the back. She didn't want to talk with them. She stood around in the front hall and thought it over by herself. Her dad's footstep stopped. It was deliberate, he said. It's not like the kid was just fooling with the gun and it went off by accident. Everybody who saw it said he took deliberate aim. I wonder when we'll hear from Mrs. Wilson, her mama said. We'll hear plenty, all right.
I reckon we will.
Now that the sun was down, the night was cold again like November. The people came in from the front porch and sat in the living room, but nobody lighted a fire. Mick's sweater was hanging on the hat rack, so she put it on and stood with her shoulders bent over to keep warm. She thought about Bubber sitting out in the cold, dark treehouse. He had really believed every word she said. But he sure deserved to worry some. He had nearly killed that baby. Mick, can't you think of some place where Bubber might be? Her dad asked.
He's in the neighborhood, I reckon.
Her dad walked up and down with the empty beer bottle in his hand. He walked like a blind man, and there was sweat on his face. The poor kid's scared to come home. If we could find him, I'd feel better. I've never laid a hand on Bubba. He oughtn't be scared of me. She would wait until an hour and a half was gone. By that time, he would be plenty sorry for what he did. She always could manage that Bubba and make him learn. After a while, there was a big excitement in the house. Her dad telephoned again to the hospital to see how baby was, and in a few minutes, Mrs. Wilson called back. She said she wanted to have a talk with them and would come to the house. Her dad still walked up and down the front room like a blind man. He drank 3 more bottles of beer. The way it all happened, she can sue my britches off. All she could get would be the house outside of the mortgage. But the way it happened, we don't have any comeback at all. Suddenly, Mick thought about something. Maybe they would really try Bubba in court and put him in a children's jail. Maybe Mrs. Wilson would send him to reform school. Maybe they would really do something terrible to Bubba. She wanted to go out to the treehouse right away and sit with him and tell him not to worry. Bubba was always so thin and little and smart. She would kill anybody that tried to send that kid out of the family. She wanted to kiss him and bite him because she loved him so much. But she couldn't miss anything. Mrs. Wilson would be there in a few minutes, and she had to know what was going on. Then she would run out and tell Bubba that all the things she said were lies, and he would really have learned the lesson he had coming to him. A 10-cent taxicab drove up to the sidewalk. Everybody waited on the front porch, very quiet and scared. Mrs. Wilson got out of the taxi with Mr. Brannan. She could hear her dad grinding his teeth together in a nervous way as they came up the steps. They went into the front room, and she followed along after them and stood in the doorway. Etta and Hazel and Bill and the boarders kept out of it.
"I've come to talk over all this with you," Mrs. Wilson said.
The front room looked tacky and dirty, and she saw Mr. Brannan notice everything. The mashed celluloid doll and the beads and junk Ralph played with were scattered on the floor. There was beer on her dad's workbench, and the pillows on the bed where her dad and Mama slept were bright gray. Mrs. Wilson kept pulling the wedding ring on and off her finger. By the side of her, Mr. Brannan was very calm. He sat with his legs crossed. His jaws were blue-black, and he looked like a gangster in the movies. He had always had this grudge against her. He always spoke to her in this rough voice, different from the way he talked to other people. Was it because he knew about the time she and Bubba swiped a pack of chewing gum off his counter? She hated him.
"It all boils down to this," said Mrs. Wilson. "Your kid shot my baby in the head on purpose."
Mick stepped into the middle of the room.
"No, he didn't," she said. "I was right there. Bubba had been aiming that gun at me and Ralph and everything around there. He just happened to aim it at baby, and his finger slipped. I was right there."
Mr. Brannan rubbed his nose and looked at her in a sad way. She sure did hate him.
"I know how you all feel, so I want to come to the point right now."
Mick's mama rattled a bunch of keys, and her dad sat very still with his big hands hanging over his knees.
"Bubba didn't have it in his mind beforehand," Mick said. "He just..."
Mrs. Wilson jabbed the ring on and off her finger.
"Wait a minute. I know how everything is. I could bring it to court and sue for every cent you own."
Her dad didn't have any expression on his face. "I'll tell you one thing," he said. "We don't have much to sue for. All we got is..."
"Just listen to me," said Mrs. Wilson. "I haven't come here with any lawyer to sue you. Bartholomew, Mr. Brannan, and I talked it over when we came, and we just about agree on the main points. In the first place, I want to do the fair, honest thing. And in the second place, I don't want baby's name mixed up in no common lawsuit at her age."
There was not a sound, and everybody in the room sat stiff in their chairs. Only Mr. Brannan halfway smiled at Mick, but she squinted her eyes back at him in a tough way. Mrs. Wilson was very nervous, and her hand shook when she lighted a cigarette.
"I don't want to have to sue you or anything like that. All I want is for you to be fair. I'm not asking you to pay for all the suffering and crime baby went through with until they gave her something to sleep. There's not any pay that would make up for that. And I'm not asking you to pay for the damage this will do to her career and the plans we had made. She's going to have to wear a bandage for several months. She won't get to dance in the soiree. Maybe there'll even be a little bald place on her head."
Mrs. Wilson and her dad looked at each other like they was hypnotized. Then Mrs. Wilson reached around to her pocketbook and took out a slip of paper.
"The things you got to pay are just the actual price of what it will cost us in money. There's baby's private room in the hospital and a private nurse until she can come home. There's the operating room and the doctor's bill, and for once I intend the doctor to be paid right away. Also, they shaved all baby's hair off, and you got to pay me for the permanent wave I took her to Atlanta to get, so when her hair grows back natural, she can have another one. And there's the price of her costume and other little extra bills like that. I'll write all the items down just as soon as I know what they'll be. I'm trying to be just as fair and honest as I can, and you'll have to pay the total when I bring it to you."
Her mama smoothed her dress over her knees and took a quick, short breath. "Seems to me like the children's ward would be a lot better than a private room. When Mick had pneumonia, I said a private room." Mr. Brannan held out his white, stumpy hands and balanced them like they was on scales. "Maybe in a day or two, baby can move into a double room with some other kid." Mrs. Wilson spoke hard-boiled.
"You heard what I said.
Long as your kid shot my baby, she certainly ought to have every advantage until she gets well.
You're in your rights, her dad said. God knows we don't have anything now, but maybe I can scrape it up. I realize you're not trying to take advantage of us, and I appreciate it. We'll do what we can.
She wanted to stay and hear everything that they said, but Bubber was on her mind. When she thought of him sitting up in the dark, cold treehouse, thinking about Sing Sing, she felt uneasy. She went out of the room and down the hall toward the back door. The wind was blowing, and the yard was very dark, except for the yellow square that came from the light in the kitchen. When she looked back, she saw Portia sitting at the table with her long, thin hands up on her face, very still. The yard was lonesome, and the wind made quick, scary shadows and a mourning kind of sound in the darkness. She stood under the oak tree. Then just as she started to reach for the first limb, a terrible notion came over her. It came to her all of a sudden that Bubber was gone. She called him, and he did not answer. She climbed quick and quiet as a cat.
Say, Bubber!
Without feeling in the box, she knew he wasn't there. To make sure, she got into the box and felt in all the corners. The kid was gone. He must have started down the minute she left. He was running away for sure now, and with a smart kid like Bubber, it was no telling where they'd catch him. She scrambled down the tree and ran to the front porch. Mrs. Wilson was leaving, and they had all come out to the front steps with her.
Dad, she said, we gotta do something about Bubber. He's run away. I'm sure he left our block. We all gotta get out and hunt him.
Nobody knew where to go or how to begin. Her dad walked up and down the street, looking in all the alleys. Mr. Brannan telephoned for a 10-cent taxi for Mrs. Wilson and then stayed to help with the hunt. Mr. Singer sat on the banisters of the porch, and he was the only person who kept calm. They all waited for Mick to plan out the best places to look for Bubber, but the town was so big, and the little kid so smart, that she couldn't think what to do. Maybe he had gone to Portia's house over in Sugar Hill. She went back into the kitchen where Portia was sitting at the table with her hands up to her face. I got this sudden notion he went down to your house. Help us hunt him.
How come I didn't think of that? I bet a nickel my little scared Bubba been staying in my home all the time.
Mr. Brannan had borrowed an automobile. He and Mr. Singer and Mick's dad got into the car with her and Portia. Nobody knew what Bubba was feeling except her. Nobody knew he had really run away like he was escaping to save his life. Portia's house was dark, except for the checkered moonlight on the floor. As soon as they stepped inside, they could tell there was nobody in the two rooms. Portia lighted the front lamp. The rooms had a colored smell, and they were crowded with cut-out pictures on the walls and the lace table covers and lace pillows on the bed. Bubber was not there.
He been here, Portia suddenly said. I can tell somebody been in here.
Mr. Singer found the pencil and a piece of paper on the kitchen table. He read it quickly, and then they all looked at it. The writing was round and scraggly, and the smart little kid hadn't misspelled but one word. The note said, Dear Portia, I gone to Florida. Tell everybody. Yours truly, Bubber Kelly. They stood around, surprised and stumped. Her dad looked out the doorway and picked his nose with his thumb in a worried way. They were all ready to pile in the car and ride toward the highway leading south.
Wait a minute, Mick said. Even if Bubber is 7 years old, he's got brains enough not to tell us where he's going if he wants to run away. That about Florida is just a trick.
A trick? Her dad said.
Yeah. There are only two places Bubber knows very much about. One is Florida, and the other is Atlanta. Me and Bubber and Ralph have been on the Atlanta road many a time. He knows how to start there, and that's where he's headed. He always talks about what he's going to do when he gets a chance to go to Atlanta.
They went out to the automobile again. She was ready to climb into the back seat when Portia pinched her on the elbow.
You know what Bubba done, she said in a quiet voice. Don't you tell nobody else, but my Bubba done also taken my gold earrings off my dresser. I never thought my Bubba would have done such a thing to me.
Mr. Brannan started the automobile. They rode slow, looking up and down the streets for Bubber, headed toward the Atlanta Road. It was true that in Bubber there was a tough, mean streak. He was acting different today than he had ever acted before. Up until now, he was always a quiet little kid who never really done anything mean. When anybody's feelings were hurt, it always made him ashamed and nervous. Then how come he could do all the things he had done today? They drove very slow out to the Atlanta Road. They passed the last line of houses and came to the dark fields and woods. All along, they had stopped to ask if anyone had seen Bubber. Has a little barefooted kid in corduroy knickers been by this way? But even after they had gone about 10 miles, nobody had seen or noticed him. The wind came in cold and strong from the open windows, and it was late at night. They rode a little farther, and then went back toward town. Her dad and Brannan wanted to look up all the children in the second grade, but she made them turn around and go back on the Atlanta Road again. All the while, she remembered the words she had said to Bubber about Baby being dead, and Sing Sing, and Warden Laws, about the small electric chairs that were just his size, and hell. In the dark, the words had sounded terrible. They rode very slow for about half a mile out of town, and then suddenly she saw Bubber. The lights of the car showed him up in front of them very plain. It was funny. He was walking along the edge of the road, and he had his thumb out trying to get a ride. Porsche's butcher knife was stuck in his belt, and on the wide, dark road, he looked so small that it was like he was 5 years old instead of 7. They stopped the automobile, and he ran to get in. He couldn't see who they were, and his face had the squint-eyed look it always had when he took aim with a marble. Her dad held him by the collar. He hit with his fists and kicked. Then he had the butcher knife in his hand. Their dad yanked it away from him just in time. He fought like a little tiger in a trap, but finally they got him into the car. Their dad held him in his lap on the way home, and Bubber sat very stiff, not leaning against anything. They had to drag him into the house, and all the neighbors and the boarders were out to see the commotion. They dragged him into the front room, and when he was there, he backed off into a corner, holding his fists very tight, and with his squinted eyes looking from one person to the other like he was ready to fight the whole crowd. He hadn't said one word since they came into the house until he began to scream, "Mick done it! I didn't do it! Mick done it!" There were never any kind of yells like the ones Bubber made. The veins in his neck stood out, and his fists were hard as little rocks.
"You can't get me! Nobody can get me!" he kept yelling.
Mick shook him by the shoulder. She told him the things she had said were stories. He finally knew what she was saying, but he wouldn't hush. It looked like nothing could stop that screaming.
"I hate everybody! I hate everybody!"
They all just stood around. Mr. Brannan rubbed his nose and looked down at the floor. Then finally, he went out very quietly. Mr. Singer was the only one who seemed to know what it was all about. Maybe this was because he didn't hear that awful noise. His face was still calm, and whenever Bubber looked at him, he seemed to get quieter. Mr. Singer was different from any other man, and at times like this it would be better if other people would let him manage. He had more sense, and he knew things that ordinary people couldn't know. He just looked at Bubber, and after a while, the kid quieted down enough so that their dad could get him to bed. In the bed, he lay on his face and cried. He cried with long, big sobs that made him tremble all over. He cried for an hour, and nobody in the three rooms could sleep. Bill moved to the living room sofa, and Mick got into bed with Bubber. He wouldn't let her touch him or snug up to him. Then after another hour of crying and hiccuping, he went to sleep. She was awake a long time. In the dark, she put her arms around him and held him very close. She touched him all over and kissed him everywhere. He was so soft and little, and there was this salty, boy's smell about him. The love she felt was so hard that she had to squeeze him to her until her arms were tired. In her mind, she thought about Bubba and music together. It was like she could never do anything good enough for him. She would never hit him or even tease him again. She slept all night with her arms around his head. Then in the morning, when she woke up, he was gone. But after that night, there was not much of a chance for her to tease him anymore, her or anybody else. After he shot Baby, the kid was not ever like little Bubba again. He always kept his mouth shut, and he didn't fool around with anybody. Most of the time, he just sat in the backyard or in the coal house by himself. It got closer and closer toward Christmas time. She really wanted a piano, but naturally she didn't say anything about that. She told everybody she wanted a Mickey Mouse watch. When they asked Bubba what he wanted from Santa Claus, he said he didn't want anything. He hid his marbles and jackknife and wouldn't let anyone touch his storybooks. After that night, nobody called him Bubba anymore. The big kids in the neighborhood started calling him Baby Killer Kelly, but he didn't speak much to any person, and nothing seemed to bother him. The family called him by his real name, George. At first, Mick couldn't stop calling him Bubba, and she didn't want to stop. But it was funny how after about a week, she just naturally called him George, like the others did. But he was a different kid, George. Going around by himself, always like a person much older, and with nobody, not even her, knowing what was really in his mind. She slept with him on Christmas Eve night. He lay in the dark without talking. "Quit acting so peculiar," she said to him. "Let's talk about the wise men and the way the children in Holland put out their wooden shoes instead of hanging up their stockings." George wouldn't answer. He went to sleep. She got up at 4 o'clock in the morning and waked everybody in the family. Their dad built a fire in the front room and then let them go into the Christmas tree and see what they got. George had an Indian suit, and Ralph a rubber doll. The rest of the family just got clothes. She looked all through her stocking for the Mickey Mouse watch, but it wasn't there. Her presents were a pair of brown Oxford shoes and a box of cherry candy. While it was still dark, she and George went out on the sidewalk and cracked nigger toes and shot firecrackers and ate up the whole 2-layer box of cherry candy. And by the time it was daylight, they were sick to their stomach and tired out. She lay down on the sofa. She shut her eyes and went into the inside room.